Hello and welcome to episode 185 of Page One, the Writers Podcast. I'm Marco.
I'm Tarek.
And thanks for joining us on the podcast where we like to speak to writers of all kinds about their writing careers, find out how they got into the industry and try and get as many hints and tips as possible. And as ever, I will say that there is a great back catalogue of previous guests there, so please do go and check that one out. But this week, unsurprisingly, we have another great guest.
Yeah, we do indeed. We just finished chatting with the awesome Eliza Chan, who's a Scottish-born fiction author who's writes about East Asian mythology, kind of British folklore. She's had a whole bunch of short stories published in various places like The Dark and Fantasy Magazine. And her debut novel, Fathom Folk, which came out just February 2024, was a number one Sunday Times bestseller.
Yeah, and we chat to her about that. She tries to downplay that rather massive achievement, wrongly in our view.
Absolutely wrongly.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's a really interesting chat about, you know, the difference in writing between writing short stories and longer form fiction, and also a bit of chat about as well the, you know, representation of different cultures in stories like Fathom Folk, which there hasn't always been in publishing, and there seems to be at least a bit more of an appetite for it now, which is always a good thing. So it's a great chat, so we'll get straight into it after a quick advert for our writer's notebook, and then we'll be back at the end of the podcast with a bit more chat and to let you know about next week's guest.
But for now, on with the podcast.
The blank page. To some, it's terrifying, an obstacle to overcome. But we prefer to think of it as an opportunity, a blank canvas to be filled with all of the adventures and characters in our head. So how to overcome that fear? Well, we all know the best advice for a writer is write. Seriously, get words on the page and more will follow.
But what about later, when you start trying to pull those threads of what you've written together? What about the character you wrote about way back at the start? Who was she again? What was she carrying? And where did she leave the MacGuffin that she now really needs in the third act? Think about all those top thrillers you like to read. Or that amazing drama you just watched. What did they all have in common? Structure and planning.
As aspiring writers ourselves, we've tried many different methods to try and organise all the thoughts about the stories we want to tell. We've been there, searching for a piece of scrap paper to note something down, or making a quick note on our phone in between meetings.
Or sometimes we'll make a note in whatever notebook we're carrying, or a document on our laptop so we don't forget that great idea. Let's be honest, it can all be a bit messy, and it's easy to lose track of everything. And that's when we realise it's not just a story that needs structure and planning, but the way we gather all of our thoughts about it as well.
And so we made Page One. Page One is more than just another notebook. It's a place to put down all your ideas for your latest project, divided into easy-to-use sections that will help you plan your story, so that when that blank page comes calling, you're ready to answer. And then afterwards, once it's written, we realised you need to plan how to let people read it, so we included a section relating to submissions.
Each one is designed for one project, whether you want to write a book, screenplay, a comic, or any other kind of story. We truly believe that when you use it, it will help you get to the main event, writing your story. So we hope this helps.
We can't wait to read what you come up with.
And remember, every story starts with Page One.
Did you always want to be a writer? Because I think I'm right in saying you've had quite the array of jobs before you had your first published book. So was it always the goal?
Yes and no. So I always liked being creative. You know, I was an artist, but I was a kiddie artist, and I liked writing as a kid, but I was from a Chinese background and my parents were very much like, oh, no, no, you're not going into the arts. You're being a lawyer, a doctor or a dentist. So it was very much a hobby for me because I was told, you know, you don't do that. We don't take these sort of risks. You need something much more sensible and bill paying. So it was always kind of on hold, and I knew I was going to go to uni and do something. But at the back of my mind, I always had this, but one day I'll get the novel published. And I did, I guess. It just took a lot longer than I thought it was going to take. But yeah, definitely always wanted this since I was a kid, I.
Yeah, and as we'll get on to later on, I think it was probably worth the wait. I think I'm right in saying that you started writing. Well, I don't know if you were writing long form fiction beforehand, but your first success, I suppose, in getting published was with short fiction.
Yeah, so I kind of came at it a funny way. So I grew up near Glasgow, so I joined the Glasgow, sci fiction back then, but it's now spec fic writing group. And a lot of them were writing short fiction, and they gave some really great advice. And I muddled through my first really awful novel between, I think, the ages of like 16 to 21. I wrote this, you know, terrible insert self, half elf, tropish mess. And they did, bless them, they read it and tried to give me feedback. And I think I sent it to about one agent, two agents back in the day, where you actually had to post the whole thing, you know, in a manila envelope. And then even I realised, oh, this is a mess. And I think because all of them were writing short fiction and they were like, you know what, you just need to keep practising, I kind of fell into it sideways and started writing a bit of short fiction. And for me, it was always going to be, I'll do this for a bit until I get a bit better. And I'll do this for a bit until I get a bit better. And then I sort of got stuck in it. And I think part of it was I ended up being in circles with other short fiction writers, and it became a, you know, once you've got a couple of anthologies or publications, you want to go for the pro magazines and, you know, those sort of side goals that sort of sidetracked me.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of, like, I love short fiction. I think it's a very different art form to tell a concise story. But I also think for me, I was using it as an excuse because I really struggled to write longer form, and that was a good convenient excuse. I could write, you know, a short story, it's a lot shorter, and you got that sort of adrenaline boost when you got an acceptance, which I knew from the novel world was going to be a lot harder. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of like, no, I'm honing my craft for like 15, 20 years before I finally came back to novel writing. And I did start a couple of novels, but I really didn't ever finish them. And I think the only thing that really pushed me near when I actually completed this was I met someone on Twitter, a really nice author called Maisie Chan, who writes children's books. And we just had a chat about representation, and she was the first British Chinese author I'd ever interacted with. Like, obviously, there were some Asian Americans writing out there, but for me, it was a real eye-opener. And she offered to mentor me, and just having that accountability is actually what pushed me through this. I think without her, it would be another half-finished novel somewhere in my computer. So yeah, it took the very, very long way round to get here.
So Twitter isn't all bad then?
It wasn't all bad back in the day. I mean, I can't say you can necessarily find those relationships now, but yes, back in the day, it really was like, wow, the first British Chinese author ever met. And I mean, if it wasn't for Twitter, I wouldn't know of the existence of a lot of the Asian American authors writing in genre. Like, it really did come to light through the circles of friends I was making on there. I don't know about now. It's a different story.
Well, you said there that you were writing your short fiction because you kind of, you know, you were worried that writing longer fiction was too hard. But then how hard is it to get short fiction published? How easy is it in comparison? I mean, I'm assuming it's not an easy thing to get short stories, you know, sold to magazines and places like that.
No, I think it's probably just as difficult. I mean, I don't have the statistics, but I know because a lot of people think, oh, I'll just write short fiction, it'll be a bit faster. But there's a completely different skill set in telling a story concisely. And also a lot of short fiction is where you can really play with styles and art forms and like different voices, like first person, second person, things like that. So it's really fun that way. Mm-hmm. But in terms of getting published in the sort of magazines that have a massive readership, like fantasy and science fiction, Uncanny. It's just as bad, if not worse. I don't know. I know, like, Uncanny only generally open about once a year, and they get something thousands and thousands of submissions in that one submission period. So it's not easier, which is I think what I thought to begin with. I think it's a fun craft, but it's quite a different, like, some things obviously are transferable, but some things it's just a completely different style that you have to do because you are very restricted by that word count. I think what it can do, what the positives I'd say from it is you get a lot of rejection. So when it came to the novel and getting rejection, I don't think I was potentially more resilient to it because I'd had all those micro rejections from short fiction. And also, you know, you do get some acceptances. So there's that little serotonin burst when you've got a little anthology and your name's in it or in a magazine. And that's really lovely. And building up a network. So I know a lot of writing friends from the world of short fiction, which is really nice because I wouldn't have had that network, yeah, without all those years wandering through the short fiction markets.
And for people that are listening that are sort of wanting to get into short fiction, I mean, what is the best route into it? Is it just reading a lot of short fiction and finding where your story might be best placed, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. I would say there's a lot of different, even within the genre, sort of sci-fi fantasy genres, a lot of different magazines out there that are looking for completely different stuff. So some of it is looking for things that are quite cutting edge in terms of the use of the space and the use of the voice and the style and I guess a more literary end. And then there's other places that really are more, I guess more into, we're specifically after some Cthulhu-based stories or specifically like this is the theme. So there's anything from pulp to, you know, climate sort of fiction to cozy. It's looking around and reading around and seeing the sort of stories you like and the magazines you like. They're the ones you probably want to submit to. There's some great resources out there. There's a submissions grinder, yeah. Which is a free website where you can search basically by how long your story is, what genre it is, and it pops up showing what markets are currently open and then getting a feel for things that way. That would be the advice I'd give.
Yeah, I've looked at the submissions grinder myself, but it also tracks like the response times to short stories and stuff like that. Albeit me, as someone that was always terrible at maths, I have some difficulty parsing the graphs that they show and things like that. But it is all there, and it is a useful resource, definitely. But you turned it, well, you decided with the help of Maisie Chan, I'm going to write a longer form fiction. And so did you have an idea that you had been wanting to develop, or was that something you developed in discussion with Maisie?
No, I had an idea. So basically I'd had this idea and I'd written for NaNoWriMo a really awful first, well, how many words is it in NaNoWriMo? I've already forgotten.
It's 50,000, isn't it?
50,000, right. So I'd managed that. And I think it's the only year I'd managed it, but it was so awful, I couldn't look at it ever again. It was just like, it was me proving to myself that I could write 50,000 because I hadn't done that in so long. And then it sat in a drawer. So when she came along and she said, what do you want me to mentor you on? I said, well, I want to finish this novel that had started, you know. So I'd already had the seed idea, and really her mentorship was there to give me sort of that. I'm so like old school, I need a teacher on my back saying, here's your deadline. But her just going, I'll check in with you in 2 months. And me going, oh no, Maisie's going to be disappointed if I don't write it. That's really what pushed me through the whole first draft. And I think the really good bit of advice she gave me, because I just couldn't open that file, because the NaNoWriMo experience was great for telling me I could do 50,000, but it was in such a state, I didn't know where to begin. And she said, just don't open it. You'd remember in your head the main bones. You've told me that it's a mess. Just start from scratch, and it'll feel a lot more manageable. And she was completely right, because the main essence of the story is what I remembered, as opposed to, yeah, the chaos of that draft. And that's how we got it.
Excellent.
And that was obviously Fathom Folk, which was your first book, came out February 2024. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what the book's about and what people should expect from reading it?
So my elevator pitch is What if the Little Mermaid was a pissed off immigrant in a semi-submerged East and Southeast Asian inspired city? And it was never for the love of a man, it was for the love of her home. So the novel is basically about set in a semi-modern sort of cityscape, multicultural cityscape, and the city's half flooded. And the Fathom folk are folk like mermaids, sirens, kelpies, kappas, water dragons from all walks of life, different sea-based mythology from across different countries and cultures, and they've come onto land to work in the city due to a number of reasons, including pollution and economics. But the humans are the ones at the top, literally at the top of these skyscrapers looking down in them. And it's a novel about prejudice and discrimination and class differences, but it's also a novel for me about being someone that doesn't fit in, being part of a diaspora, but thinking, how do you change a system that might not want to be changed, that might not welcome you, but is the only place you've ever known as home? So it's, yeah, but I added mermaids because why not, basically.
And do you think with stories like that, where there is better, more representation, of people that haven't traditionally had representation in novels like this before, do you think the publishing scene is becoming more open to that sort of story, and it's being more embraced by readers as well?
I think it is to a degree. I think there's definitely more non-European based fantasy kicking around now, which I'm really glad of. Like, I love reading from other sort of points of view and seeing other sort of world building out there. I think at the moment my concern, I guess, I think because it's just baby steps, it's very much most of it in the epic fantasy and mythology retellings sort of area, which again, no shade to that, it's really well written and it's lovely. I think what I wanted to do, and is a bit to one side, is I wanted to show modernity without going to science fiction, and I think that's less developed. But then I would say generally, like, urban fantasy is a dirty word, isn't it, right now? Having a sort of modern, we call it modern contemporary secondary world fantasy, is urban fantasy by any other name. That isn't as big a market, but that is very much where I wanted to set my story, because for me, it was about, I don't want to talk about alternative history or like epic fantasy is generally, whatever culture it is, you're looking at 300-400 years ago sort of fantasy version of it. I wanted to talk about now because cities to me are quite modern and multicultural. So yeah, there is more scope, I would say, generally, but I would say it has almost become a niche box in itself. Sometimes, and I'm hoping that work like this will sort of push it a little bit more outside of epic or alternative history. But yeah, I mean, we can only hope, can't we?
Yeah. I mean, and because I think you're right. We've seen certainly a massive kind of explosion of like mythology retellings from a kind of female perspective. You know, Jennifer Saint and Madeline Miller books and stuff. Obviously, the kind of biggie ones. And how much of that you think is a trend in the sense that it's like it will kind of come to an end at some point, and how much of it is a stepping stone to a kind of permanent marketing landscape where you've got kind of more open, diverse stories? Is that a permanent destination that we're moving to, you think, or is this all just a bit of a flash in the pan trend that might die out?
I don't know. Like, I'm not a publisher or an agent. What I would say from a personal point of view is I feel like the Greek mythology retellings feels quite oversaturated. It's a whole sub-genre, isn't it? But it feels like there's so much going on there now. I'm hoping, though, that publishing itself is not just going to go, retellings are done, because it is not oversaturated when it comes to other cultures and other countries' sort of retellings. You know, there's definitely tons still out there. So I don't want publishing just to go, right, we're done. I also think retellings we're just obsessed with them as people. Yeah. I think, you know, we always, no matter what culture you're brought up in, you have your folk tales and fairy tales from childhood that you tell over and over and over again. So sort of typical one in Chinese. So Gam Yong, Jin Yong wrote Condor Heroes. And when I was a kid, basically, every 4 or 5 years, basically, they would do a TV series of the same epic sort of wuxia fantasy. And then 5 years' time, there'd be another one, and there'd be another one, and there'd be another, and you just couldn't get enough of it. Yeah. And to this day, they still go, and there's either TV series or films, and I would say it's the same in Europe with, you know, we come back to Arthur, we come back to Cinderella, Snow White, we come back to Spider-Man. I mean, it's just like, there's something comforting about that, and I don't think we will ever completely let go of that. I do like how it's modernised, and each generation brings its own themes, its own, as you say, it's now at the moment feminist retellings, so who knows, maybe in 10 years it becomes a slight twist retellings. I don't think we'll ever be done with retellings, but the sub-genres of retellings I think might change, because I feel like fairy tales have quietened down a bit. It was really big at one point, now it's Greek mythology, so I'm hoping, yeah, there'll be some other retellings. I don't know what exact subgenre. Personally, I love Arthurian retellings. I think there's a lot to play with there. Yeah, so I just think it'll keep going, but different ones.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. And was so was Fathom Folk the first novel that you had actually finished, other than this one that you wrote when you were 16?
Yes, yes.
And so what was your process in writing that? And does your writing process differ for that sort of longer form? And compared to your short stories and stuff, do you, with a short story, do you just maybe not need as plan as much or anything like that? Are there differences like that?
Oh, definitely, 100%. So short stories, generally, I just had either an idea or a character, and I would just write, because generally my short stories would sit around 3,000 to 5,000 words. So if you're halfway through and you decide, oh, wait a minute, I'm changing my mind, it's easy enough to alter. My process for writing a novel, I would say, was chaotic. I'm hoping not to replicate that process again, because it was a bit too chaotic. Because, you know, we went from, as I said, the NaNoWriMo sat in a drawer, 50k, to the first draft I did under my mentor's support. And it started off basically being London or Manchester. And I got about a third of the way in, and I realised I was really struggling with the world building, because it was really hard for me to envisage a semi-submerged British city. Mm-hmm. And I kept pulling information from East and Southeast Asia, because there's monsoons, there's flooding, there's a lot of folk that live on boats or in stilt houses. And I was going, why have I set it in basically Europe? Why have I done that to myself? So there was a massive rewrite there. It went from one point of view to 3 points of view. So there was another massive rewrite there. So I would hope the future novels are not as chaotic as that. And I think very much I was learning, because, as you said, I hadn't written a long form novel since I was 16. So I was learning as I went. Thankfully, it all turned out OK. But I wouldn't say that's necessarily the best and most efficient way to write a novel.
I mean, I guess you had your NaNo, although you didn't look back at the NaNoWriMo, I suppose that gave you some sort of structure, or some sort, you know, some elements of that allowed you to, in a way, it was a very, very long planning session, I suppose, you could look at it as. Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
And when you write, do you show your writing to other people before you send it out there or anything like that, or do you sort of hone it and then just send it out and see what happens?
No, so I've got a few beta readers, sort of like crit partners that I've had for years that I really trust and I think get my style and I get theirs. So I wouldn't have sent them the first draft, though, because it was a mess. So after about 2 or 3 drafts, when I thought, I've done as much as I can, but there's something missing, that's when I asked them to give it a read, give me some feedback. So you did that, and then I sort of tweaked it based on their feedback before I started looking for an agent. And for me, that was a really important step because sometimes you just get a feeling something's wrong, but you can't figure out why. So I think getting feedback off other people, even if they don't give you the right answer, they just sort of tell you their feeling of what's niggling them, and that can just spark something for
Yeah,
me.
absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think often it's you get feedback from people that have read it, and often they kind of say, oh, I had a problem with this, and here's what I think you should do. And you think, well, I don't think I want to do that because that's the wrong fix. But I appreciate that your problem for you that you've had with it. And sometimes all you need is that someone to say, I was struggling with this concept or this character or whatever. And then it's up to you to find, I'll fix it in a different way that it could be something at the start of the book or a little bit or something that fixes the problem. But it's knowing how much it takes from a beta reader, isn't it? Like, do you take the whole solution or do you just take their issue and work on the solution yourself separately?
Yeah, and I think like my husband's great for that. He's not a writer, but he likes to hear my ideas and he'll always give me his own ideas back. And most of them I just go, that is ridiculous. I wouldn't do that. I would do this. But just talking it out and him giving me the silly ideas is what makes me then go, don't do that. You do that. And I go, oh, okay, why didn't I think of that in the first place? I think a beta readers, for me, it's important to have more than one. Definitely, I think I had about four. And if one person just says all this stuff that no one else mentions, then you can kind of be like, okay, that might be their personal opinion or they've misunderstood or they're reading something. But if all of them have found similar issues, you think, okay, that's on me. I need to fix that. And as you say, you might not take their solutions, but if four out of four of your sample are struggling with something, then it is probably worth looking at.
Yeah, I think Stephen King said a similar thing that if 10 people give you different things, it doesn't matter. But if they're all saying the same thing, then yeah, there's maybe an issue you need to address. But so with your short stories, I want to talk about the sort of route to getting published with Fathom Folk. And with your short stories, obviously you can submit those directly yourself, and you manage it all yourself, or generally that's what happens. But with the novel, did you go down the usual route of finding an agent, finding a publisher that way, and how did that happen?
Yes, so after I'd polished it as much as I could, I started looking for agents. So again, I think knowing a lot of other authors, I'd seen some of their journeys, so I had a good idea of, right, you got to make your shortlist and all that sort of stuff. And I did, so I submitted to, I don't know, about 20 agents to start with. And I got, within a couple of weeks, I got quite a junior agent, but very keen and offered me representation. And that
Sure.
sort of absolutely kicked everything off because then you go back to the other agents going, someone's interested. Are you
Yes.
interested? And I ended up with four offers within
Brilliant.
about a month, which was wild, like completely unexpected. I do think, to be completely transparent, some of that helped that I had been kicking around. I go to conventions, I know some authors that already have agents, and maybe my name was not a big name, but they'd heard of me. I wasn't completely unknown, so maybe that did move me to the top of someone's pile. I'm not sure. And like three out of the four agents that offered were based in the UK, which again I think is quite interesting because I am UK based, and I think there was a bit of a priority there. So that, yeah, so that was lovely. So I got to choose, which I found more stressful than I thought it would because I was like, what if I make the wrong choice? But I ended up with my now.
I
Hi.
was going to ask about that because yeah, obviously it's a nice position for authors to be in at that point because everyone's wanting an agent, and then if you get multiple offers, I mean, what were the factors that went into your decision? Did you speak to people? How did you make that final decision?
Yeah, so I spoke to all the agents on the phone and sort of asked for their strategy, like what they liked about the novel, where they would place it, who they'd submit it to just get a feel of did they really get it. But also all of them wanted a bit of editing before we went out to a publisher. So again, what sort of edit changes would they make, and did I agree with them, I guess? Because if they wanted me to make some changes that I disagreed with, then potentially they didn't really align with what I was seeing myself doing. But I also reached out to some other clients of theirs just to get a feel for how they were as an agent behind the scenes. And then after that, I really just went with my gut. I think after a while, you're just like, I'm overthinking everything. So the agent I chose in the end is one that's a bit more established. So he's done more deals. I had a few friends that had already were represented by him and were quite happy with him. And he was probably most on my list before I started of like, oh, if he offered me representation, he'd be one of my dream agents. And that's who I went with in the end. But I think ultimately, I think if people worry a lot that this is like their only chance. But I think I've now, on the other side, see that a lot of people have parted ways from their agent and they've had two or three agents over their career. And ultimately, it's a business relationship. And that, you know, businesses do come to an end. You know, you might change your agent further down. It's not a one shot and you're done, even though it feels like that at the moment you're in it. But yeah, I'm happy with my choice. And yeah, still with them.
I think that's a really good point. I certainly chat to authors who have said similar, you know, and that it's almost more unusual to have the same agent throughout your entire career. And it's you know, as you say, it is a business, you know, relationship, and it's that kind of quasi kind of business and friendship, etc. And the more pal you get with them, the kind of more difficult it feels that you're kind of breaking up with someone. That's kind of awkward.
And also, I think there's a thing that plays into it, which is that it is, you know, it is very difficult to get an agent in the first place.
So once you find someone,
exactly.
I don't want to start from scratch again. Yeah, exactly. I think there's a lot of people off ever moving an agent is the thought of going back into the cold again. And it took me 2-3 years for an agent. Do I want to do this again? But the difference is that you're not the same person you were. That first time, or you know, hopefully you've had some published book, and I think even if you haven't had anything published, the fact that you're with an agent already, that you're finding another agent, shows that someone else independently thought you were a good writer and you wrote good stuff of a high quality, and that itself is a watermark of or a mark of success, I think. So I think it's I think you're right. I think people out there who are nervous about changing agents, it's something which everyone does, I think, 2-3 times over the course of their career, and it's a normal thing. But getting back to Fathom Folk, obviously it's been a huge success. It came out February just this year, and it was, am I right in saying, number one in the Sunday Times upon release? I mean, that must have been pretty exciting.
It was exciting. It wasn't quite on release, so I mean, yeah, your listeners are probably know this by now. It was picked by one of the sub boxes, so that is how it got quite a massive boost. The week they delivered all the boxes out is where the boost came from.
It's still there. It still gets to the top of the list.
It's still there. And it's like,
wait, are you trying to say that's not that won't count as an official?
I don't know. I feel like I've cheated the system, but you know, like. But and it's also like I was incredibly lucky. It was quite a quiet week, I would say, and like in comparison, like the other figures, because I know some weeks when the big hitters come out, it wouldn't have been number one. But yeah, I'll take it. I'll write it anywhere I can. Absolutely. Number one bestseller.
Absolutely, you can put your books going forward forever.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. I mean, these boxes are, they're becoming bigger and bigger because they're everywhere now. There's three or four, and I know some places don't count them, and some places, you know, and so certain boxes don't get counted and certain boxes do. And I never quite understand how they decide, if they're affiliated with a bookstore or something, some kind of process.
Bestseller lists as a whole are a strange beast, because I think the New York Times curate their list in a way. So it's not even to do with the best-selling books. It's just what they think are the best of the books that are selling.
So they actually pick...
Yeah.
They make up the list. It's not just sale numbers.
No, they curate it. Yeah, they decide.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, I know a couple of authors who technically, in terms of figures, should have gotten the New York Times bestseller list, but they got discounted because they were genre, which is offensive.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And then there's also all these stories that So the New York Times list, they take it from certain bookshops. So they don't take the figures across the country. They go to certain bookshops and ask how many they've sold. And the people that know all those bookshops, like certain politicians in America, will just go and mass buy hundreds of books from each of those
Yeah, I've definitely
bookshops.
heard of folk doing that before. It sounds like the old kind of Nielsen way. They used to go around to certain people's houses and say, "What did you watch last night?" And then, they like extrapolate that
Yeah,
up to
exactly.
to the whole nation, but it'd be based on like four households or whatever.
So, Fathom Folk in any
But again,
manner means
basically,
it's been number
number
one.
one Sunday Times. That's the most
Yes,
important thing.
exactly.
That takes
So, I
Thank
mean,
you.
that you try and downplay it, but it's, great achievement, and it must feel great that that's happened with your debut novel, and give you some confidence going into your next one as well.
Yeah, I mean it's brilliant. I've had so much support. I think there's a lot of fear, I think, when you finally, like this has been a dream since I was a kid and you
Yeah.
finally get it, and then you think, no, but it's not going to be as good as I think it is. And I mean, I've been incredibly lucky. I've been listening to things like Publishing Rodeo. I know this does not happen for everyone, but the support my publishers put behind it has been amazing. The cover has done so much of the heavy lifting. It's stunning, which has made all the social media sort of bloggers and Instagrammers and TikTokers want to talk about it. So it's basically been free media, which has been great. But my publisher have pushed it, and they did arcs, and it's gone over quite well. I would say some people don't like it, but there are always going to be people that don't. But I think it's starting to find its readership, and I think it's been lovely. It's just been, I still don't believe it. I think that's why I downplay everything, because I'm like, nah, come
Yeah,
on,
exactly.
you're not going to realize tomorrow that I just made words up and put them in an order.
Yeah, I suspect that feeling. I think a lot of authors have that feeling throughout their whole careers, in fact. It never quite feels real. But so what are you working on just now? What's the next book in the pipeline?
So Fathom Folk is a duology, so I am doing the edits on book two. So I'm not sure how much I can tell you other than it's the end of the
Yeah, no, that's
duology.
fine.
Continuation is hopefully out next year if everything goes to plan. And that's as far as you've got. And then I'm sort of tinkering away at another novel that I want to do after that. I have no idea if I'm going to get to if they want to buy this or not yet. It's unclear, but I'm having fun basically. I've had enough of, sadly, as much as I love the watery world and all my metaphors and mermaids, I need a break for now. So I'm going to hopping vampires instead, because
Oh,
why not?
nice.
Hopping
Hopping,
vampires.
yeah,
Yeah,
that's
hopping
intriguing.
what does the hopping entail? Is it
The
as itself?
hopping. The hopping vampire is from Chinese traditional sort of folklore,
Okay.
and you call them vampires because it's vampire zombies, they're sort of in between, but there's some sort of monster. The reason they hop is because apparently when people used to have to, so people used to exhume bodies and move them, because if your family was moving, you would take the bodies of your ancestors with them, because otherwise they would become hungry ghosts. And apparently they used to do this in the middle of the night, because no one wants to see a bunch of dead bodies, it's bad luck. And they would put them. They would put them on poles under their arms. I'm not doing this.
Right.
Poles under their arms on both sides, and there'd be a carrier at the front, a carrier at the back, moving these lines of, it looks like walking corpses. And so I guess if you woke up and you looked bleary-eyed across the landscape, you would just see what looked like a bunch of people hopping
Yeah.
along.
That is
And that's
very
how,
spooky.
yeah, the sort of spooky monster mythology folk tales came about.
Ah.
Yeah, but they were made very famous by a bunch of 1980s Hong Kong films, including Mr. Vampire, which were very silly, sort of equivalent of Hammer House films. And I love that. And I just kind of wanted to write something about these hopping vampires that no one, they're not sexy at all, by the way. They're not like Western
Yeah.
vampires. You would not want to make out with these vampires. They are grey and gross, but they're kind of nostalgic for me. So I've started writing quite a nostalgic, cheesy book about hopping vampires and basically Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But yeah, Chinese version, for a
Brilliant, cool.
laugh.
Look forward to that one.
Very good to
Before we wrap up, I did want to ask about, I read that you've got a love of tabletop gaming, and which is, I find, you know, I love that as well, but I find that writers in this especially seem to be drawn to this because obviously there is a huge opportunity for storytelling and that sort of thing. Is that what attracts you to it?
Partly. I think I really like being sociable, I think, more than anything. Mm. So I really got into tabletop gaming as a meeting up with friends and we'd all play a game together. And I don't like ones where you backstab each other. Like, I hate things like Risk. I can't handle it. Yeah. I find it really upsetting when my friends lie and backstab. But I love cooperative games or games of, as you say, a real storyline to them, like the legacy games that have become more popular. And I really enjoy that sort of social aspect more than anything. I think my only issue with tabletop games is so many of them are grounded in historical periods that were quite uncomfortable in hindsight, when you're like, look, we're colonizing this place or cutting down its resources, and you think, oh, how come we've ended up here? But I really like stuff like The Captain is Dead is really fun, or like Wingspan, things that are quite, not directly aggressive towards your friends is what I like.
Kind of asymmetrical, kind of play your own game a little bit and then just see who's done the best at the end.
Yeah.
Cool. What was the last book that you read?
And the last book I read was Darker by Four by June C.L. Tan, who I'm doing an event with this Thursday, which is like this fun YA book that's basically based in her love of anime and like Chinese dramas and computer games and stuff. And it's just very fun. And I really like that it's anime inspired, because back in the day people would start turn their nose up at that, like, oh
yeah.
Whereas now I feel like it's really more acceptable and more fun, and it's a really good fun read if you like magic skills and monster hunters and gods coming to upset plans.
Nice. What about the last film that you watched?
Last film I watched was June Part 2, which was good. I enjoyed it. I think it was, to me, it was slightly overlong. It could have been cut for at least half an hour. But I like what they did with Chani's character and the actually bringing the female characters some agency and some personality. I do think they missed a bit of the like weirdness of the books, I guess. I think they tried to make it a lot more serious. And like, I love the message about someone being put in this pedestal as a messiah and how sort of wrong it was in a way. But I think I also wanted to see like the Spacing Guild and weirdness a bit more. I really enjoyed it. That respect.
Cool. Nice. And what about TV? What are you watching on TV at the moment?
TV, I tend to do one really like easygoing comfort watch and then one thing that makes me think, because I can't do them. Yeah, I basically need both. So my easygoing like cozy watch is Spy Times Family, which is an anime about a spy who needs to have a fake family and accidentally recruits an assassin and a little girl that can read minds, and it's very cute. And, you know, they're dysfunctional, but they end up having this lovely found family. And in terms of complicated making me think, I'm watching The Three Body Problem at the moment.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I've not seen that, but yeah, is it good?
Yeah.
Have you read the book?
I've not read the book, right, so I'm intrigued, and we're only about halfway through. I think it's been really good for me. The reason I didn't read the book is because the sort of hard science intimidated me, and I think it's nice seeing that visually. I think it's got a lot of really interesting ideas, and we'll see where it goes, I guess. But yeah.
Yeah, we've been watching that as well. We've got one episode left. I don't know, it's not really worked for me, I don't think. It's kind of an odd, like, there's parts that I really like actually weirdly makes me want to read the book, because I think the hard science stuff is the stuff that I like the most, and I kind of would like to see more exploring of that kind of stuff. And it kind of makes me think of someone watching something like The Flash, like the TV show, like all the teen, the teen characters. They're not teens, they're scholars, but it feels very kind of like teen drama at times. They kind of annoy me. I hope it actually puts me off a little bit, but I do love the kind of scope of it and the how big it is and the kind of ideas of it all are quite cool.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Like, I think the thing I like is I don't read a lot of science fiction because I struggle with some of the hard science, but I watch a lot of science fiction because I find it a lot more accessible and I love the ideas. I'd agree with you, the three body problem. The characters are not really characters to me. They're just there to tell the plot.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, well, the very, very last thing we always do is a super quick fire either or. And I always say there's no right answer to any of these apart from perhaps one of them. But we'll start off with short stories or books or full length.
I know. books.
TV or cinema?
TV.
Night owl or early bird?
Early bird.
Music or no music when you're writing?
Oh, music with no lyrics.
Okay. And the last one, a paper book or an ebook?
But paper book to have and put in my bookshelf, but ebook because I do a lot of my reading in the dark because my son's asleep beside me and I can't hold a paper book open.
So if you had to pick one.
A paper book.
Oh man, I thought you always make that mistake, Tarek.
I would have taken the word. Tarek wants people to say ebook, and yeah,
I feel ebook just gets a bad rap, and no one ever fights for it. So I feel like I just got to stand up for it.
ebooks are so much more accessible and convenient. But I think
listen, you've made your bed. Don't try and backtrack now and make ebook feel better.
But the dream, I was saying, my childhood dream was not to be on like a phone.
Exactly.
I know. I totally agree. That is a very fair point. Yeah.
Absolutely.
No one ever dreams of themselves being on an ebook. They dream of themselves being on the shelf. That's fair.
So, even with the question changed, Tarek, to paper book rather than ebook, which some have said that the use of real is
yes, because an ebooks unfair, are real as well. Of
yes,
course.
Exactly. Yeah. Still didn't make a difference at the end of the day. Although you could have claimed that one as a win almost, and you pushed.
I think
it
I should
too
stop because people always give that kind of response. Like, well, I love paper books are great, but ebooks are so good because this and then I'm like, oh, here we go, yes, and then they pull the rug out from under me. So I wonder if I should just stop at that point and not clarify it and just say,
yeah,
that sounds like a win. Yeah.
I think that would be a better tactic for you. But on the subject of Dune, I haven't seen Dune 2.
I've not seen Dune 2 yet either.
Villeneuve's films, generally. Arrival's probably my favourite film ever. Mm-hmm. But I've been watching Dune Part 1 again with my daughters because I was wanting to get them to see Dune Part 2 because I do want to see it. But I don't know, there's just I've not read the books, so hands up there, but I find it odd for someone that, you know, I like sci-fi, I like stories with great lore and world building and things like that, but I struggle
everything
to
in it that you think you should
it's,
like,
it's got all the ingredients, but
it's got the villainy,
I just struggle to get into it as much as I thought I would, even on a second viewing of Part 1, you know.
I probably agree with you, to be honest. I haven't seen Part 2 yet. Saw Part 1 in the cinema. I haven't seen it since. And I remember enjoying it, but not being blown away by it. Or as some people were, some people were saying it was the kind of best sci-fi film ever. And I know Dune is a really, high
iconic.
Up there.
Yeah.
Iconic story. And I have to say, I read the book before seeing the film. And I didn't actually think the book was that great. Like, it didn't really work for me. And I know I'm probably the minority of that. I felt like Dune, very much the book and actually the film of Part 1, had a really good first kind of act or third up until the kind of assault on the family. And then after that, the book got quite boring for me. It never really gripped me after that. And I felt this, the film part one was very similar. Like it really kind of felt quite slow.
Yeah, the film, certainly part one film suffers from being half a story. You know, I've never seen a film that is more openly half a story.
Yeah.
It just sort of ends in the middle of a scene almost. Which is fine, and it may be that Dune part two, when I watch both of them together, is what I need to do to really get into it. But yeah, I don't know why, it's a strange one. I would have thought that it would pull me in more.
No, as you say, especially because based on who's making it. I mean, I also love his stuff. Blade Runner, 2049, Arrival, Sicario are all Prisoners. Brilliant. He's a phenomenal filmmaker. But yeah, Dune just didn't quite work for me. But also the book didn't quite work for me. So I don't know if it's... I can't really blame him. I'll blame Frank Herbert. That shit book.
Yeah, there you go.
I will say what I enjoyed. I enjoyed Dune more than Three Body Problem, which I was kinder to it when we were chatting to Eliza, but I have to say it's not really working for me at all. I'm not enjoying it. It's just very... I don't know. There's some parts of it I like. Like the concept, some of the sci-fi concepts are cool. It feels kind of Arthur C. Clarke in a lot of ways, the kind of time dilation and these alien spaceships, alien people from 400 years on their way, blah, blah, blah. But spoilers. But yeah, it's, I don't know. It's not really, it's not, I think it maybe built up my head too much as well as this kind of big, massive event TV.
Watch Shogun. And you chose to watch Three.
No, Bodies. I know. I'm waiting for Shogun to be all there. I will watch Shogun. That is on my list. I love Japanese stuff. So that's going to be
Shogun is very good. But anyway, we're rambling on about stuff that had nothing really to do with that chat with Eliza. So thank you very much to Eliza for coming on to the podcast. I thought that was a really interesting chat. And you know, it is interesting, and I think very important that there is more representation being found in publishing, in books, in stories like this, because I feel that representation such as there was in the past was limited to a very sort of niche area of types of stories that publishers, quotes, allowed to get published. And I feel that there is slowly, as ever with these things, there is slowly a widening of that, which is always a good thing, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting the kind of delineation that Eliza makes between kind of the folklore and the subgenres of myth retelling, etc. And I think she's probably right in the sense that I think Greek mythology retellings have been massive for a few years, and they probably are at that kind of saturation point, aren't they? But I also agree with her that it would be a shame if the marketplace took that to mean people are sick of mythology books completely, because that's just absolutely. There's so much more, isn't there, as she says, than just the Greek stuff. So I think I'm hoping that it is a kind of a movement towards bigger, wider, expansive stories told by different people, and we're not just kind of seeing it come to an end.
Yeah, and I'm absolutely here for a story about hopping vampires, which is
that sounds really cool.
That sounds very cool.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so yeah, you can go and grab Fathom Folk and keep it in the bestseller lists. We'll put a link in the podcast description. But next week, we have another great guest.
Yeah, next week, we're chatting with Jasper Ford, who has a really interesting way in to his writing career. He started off working on films. Focus Puller on GoldenEye.
Yes.
Pretty cool.
Worked
pretty
films,
cool film to work on. Uh-huh. And now he's written, tons. He's written about, 10 plus, 15 plus books now, different series, a kind of really esoteric kind of...
Yeah, I was going to say wildly series. Imaginative stuff, the sort of stuff that not a lot of people can... I mean, we talked to him about this, and to him, he just says it's just... It's just the way he thinks. But, it's the nursery crime series where it's like treating Humpty Dumpty's death as a real murder to the extent that he researched how a bullet would react being shot through and ate a large egg and things like this.
And there's the Thursday Next series where he's got people who chases a thriller series, who chases the baddie through different books, like Jane Eyre and stuff. And just really... out there stuff, really cool.
It is. So, and as you would expect from someone with those ideas, it's a really, really interesting chat. So please do tune in for that one. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please do take the time to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast app, as that helps us to continue to get great guests on the podcast.
And if you want to get in touch, you can always reach us by emailing us at podcast@rightgear.co.uk, or you can send us a tweet in the Twitter machine, but an X in the X machine doesn't quite work. What do you call it? What is it called now?
I have no idea. I just call it Twitter, though. I refuse to call it.
Yeah, I agree. you can get that in any social media platform by just searching for @UKPageOne.
Yes, and you'll find us there, not tweeting or posting very much.
Or excellent.
Yeah, exactly. Have a great week, and we will speak to you again next week.
See you later.